Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. It's 46 degrees out, but oddly, it doesn't feel that way. Today, we're going to talk about something that goes deep, deep back in human history. And something you can strive for every single day and make a really cool game out of it. Because the gifts will keep coming. Every single tiny increment of progress you make in this particular realm, and this is to achieve what I'm going to call the absolute mind. There's a brand new video game species that have come out on the cell phones, especially, and iPads, what have you. This technically kind of happened in games like Diablo back in the day, or technically happened with games like SimCity. But a lot of games nowadays just go forever, don't they? You just play them forever. And you just keep building and building, like World of Warcraft. You just keep building up your characters, getting more levels, getting more stuff. And even though expansions come out, your character still starts out with a lot of good stuff. And the harder you worked in the previous expansion, you start off with a lot of goodies, making the new one a lot easier to do. But I've been playing this game called Lumber Inc., and it's a good analogy for what I'm going to talk about here, which is that you play this lumber mill and you get it up to the peak point, and then they go, hey, you've graduated to the next lumber mill. And so you're like, well, what the hell does that mean? You push a button and it goes all the way back to blank. All your progress seems like it's gone. Except your little worker bees, if you leveled any of those people, they stay leveled. So it's a little bit faster, but then your objectives are a little bit harder. Very traditional mechanism inside video games. Why mention that in the middle of this thing? Because I haven't even defined what the absolute mind is. Here's the concept. And again, if you're a deep thinker, this will be candy for you to eat every day in everything that you do. And it's sort of a nice side game you could play in real life with your brain, regardless if the world is good, the world is bad. Whether it's creative, whether it's logical, you're going to have a blast. Everything you see, touch, smell, and think is going to contribute to this game and the leveling thereof. The reset of the game goes like this. I think most of you know implicitly that you grow up either a predominantly left-brain person or predominantly a right brain person. You're creative. So you're either logical or you're creative. Some of you, because of your loves in life and your exposure to things, which thus turns into your loves, which is your purpose, you might end up on a path where you're sort of pushing each one of these up at the same time. What ends up occurring when you get into that realm, and this was the story of my life, because I was an artist and I was this little engineer. You know, first it starts off with Legos, then it gets into programming, then building electronics and all kinds of stuff. Is that I was a late bloomer. But when I got there, I had an absolute understanding of something. More so than, say, someone approaching it strictly from the left brain. Like, I would see software written that was brilliant, but horribly designed, and not really addressing the overall abstract need of the user, because the logical thinking programmer couldn't think about contingencies where, hey, yeah, well, I like your little drawing tool, but I'm using it like this instead. And they're like, I didn't program it like that. Your creative person often does terrible in school, but not so bad in life. Because why? Life is abstract, and so is creativity. But the more you can get sort of the logic into a creative mind, magic happens, right? So my definition of the absolute mind is the following. And it comes with a giant reset. And it's very exciting. I think for me, this has happened naturally and organically because no one ever coined the phrase with me and no one ever explained it to me. And I'm going to go into where it really started to dawn on me. This show has tremendously helped me merge my two brains. Not that I didn't have it pretty well working together for probably a couple decades before, but to formally understand something that is going on is a profound epiphany to your existence, isn't it? if you can stimulate your left brain as much as you have stimulated your right brain, and your right brain as much as your left, and age enough that you experience the universe to an ample degree in both hemispheres, I mean, you've mitigated tons of logical problems in your life. And it could be on point things like balancing a really intense accounting situation at work, or it could just simply be you've had to be a logistical genius to handle three kids, you know, or your family and three kids and your work and everything. So you're being very logistical. You'll know that the more abstract you are in dealing with those requirements, especially as it addresses itself to stress, the less stress you feel, because you're like, I'm expecting the unexpected. So when it happens, I don't stress. I just go, wow, let's solve the problem. On the creative side, and again, there are millions of different things that are creative, but they're on point things in being creative. Being an artist of any kind, is a very obviously right brain side of things. But seeing life as it truly exists, almost in a stressless paradigm, you do acknowledge severity and the need to execute things very quickly, procedures to keep yourself alive and keep your family safe and what have you. But in the end, you're sort of that Spicoli guy from Fast Times at Ridgemont High. You're just like letting it happen, man. You know, well, that's weird. You know, and it's like a bomb what goes off. There will come a time when you consciously will realize, and especially after this episode, if you've never thought about it this way, you may discover, you may have already discovered by me just hinting at this definition that you actually may already be there. But there comes a point of this harmonic between the left and right brain. We talked about the sympathetic harmonies where they weaponized, you know, using one frequency in one ear and one frequency in the other ear, and it creates a third frequency in the center of your consciousness inside your mind, and they can create seven states of consciousness as of 1967 via a DOD experiment. But doesn't, in our realm, it doesn't have to be evil, right? It can just be, wow. The brain.fm product I recommend to you guys for meditation and really just easing your, you know, calming your mind while you're trying to do something very intense. Every single person that's ever had the temerity to download the app and try it out, especially with headphones, they've immediately come back with 5-star ratings. They're like, oh my God, this totally took down my stress for the day. Helped me concentrate. First time I used it, I cracked a scene in a screenplay that had been plugging me for 2 weeks. I played it. The soundtrack was just perfect underneath this wave system that was going on in the software. And I just started seeing the movie scene. I was like, oh my God. I was like, I was being entertained by the universe's imagination, you know? But this is where we get back to the game analogy. When you consciously realize that you've got both these hemispheres harmonizing together, metaphorically, the image that I want you to see in your head is that you have sort of this more geometric rattling of electricity, plasma energy on the left. It's making all kinds of spiral graph, very geometric electricity going on. And on the right side, you're seeing very organic, flowery sort of shapes. It can do anything. It can do scribbles. It can do a Jackson Pollock over there. And they're going. And they're at certain levels of energy. There are certain levels of diameter based on how much you put individual thoughts into these two hemispheres. But when you're raised initially, especially as society matures now and gets rid of the right brain, which allows you to see through the emperor's clothing phenomenon, right? They start to harmonize together. And it's almost like a portal into your brain in that room over there. And there's a portal into the room that's this brain over here. And when they go together, what ends up happening is, if you've ever seen the finale of Dark Crystal, it's like the Skeksis and those smooth dudes coming together to make a third person, right? There's a hole. And it's a new portal into a brand new world, which is your absolute mind. And the things that you can conceive of within the absolute mind can't fit in the other two rooms. The other two rooms can't contain them because they have to be pure and the logic or the creative side. Now, I realize, technically speaking, that some of you could go, oh, hey, man, that old left brain right thing was, you know, some kooky German psychologist back in the day making shit up. Well, all I can say is use observable reality to prove to yourself that there are people that cannot have a creative thought to save their soul, and there's people that can't have a logical thought to save their soul. So, however it's distributed in the mind, inside your brain cavity, it's pretty powerful and pretty amazing how when your soul attaches to your body, that this stuff is distributed thusly. Whether it's on top of itself and it's not truly left and right, don't worry about that so much. You're good at what you do, as I always say on this show. So if you do a lot of left thinking, you're going to be left prone. A lot of right thinking, you're right prone. You can, like I've said in several episodes where my writing mentor found me in 2007, he said, man, you're way too left right now and pragmatic to be good at the executing the ideas that you have that are very creative. And he was right. And I had to go back into the art realm of my life and really get back into my writing and really just massage my brain. It was like riding a bike for me because I had been there most of my life, but I was also running a game company at the time. So I was in sort of the logistical operation of the company, sales, all that kind of stuff. The thing is once you start having these new thoughts, they will feel more complete to your soul. They'll be more three-dimensional. It will be an illustration, almost like a dream. Instead of being a two-dimensional painting, it'll be a three-dimensional world that you suddenly live in. Many of you who have, quote-unquote, awakened in these last couple decades here, at whatever interval, you will know that for the very first time you saw whatever side you weren't seeing. And all of a sudden, you're able to start thinking about the stuff that you found because in the past you weren't even looking. And when you start waking up, you have pieces and parts. It's almost like being an archaeologist, right? Now, you know, let's take archaeology as an example. To be a true archaeologist, you should go to school, I guess, or be mentored by a genius who's going to teach you how to dig out a hole and not screw everything up, to grid everything out, take all the photographs, try to make sure we understand what grid we're working in, we find things so that as we reconstruct the history, we can prove to those who are observing where we found the pottery pieces or the knife or whatever it is, right? However, even without a giant education in that, someone could say, okay, in that corner right there, you see that pottery sticking out of the mud. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay, here's what we're going to do. You're going to use this brush. You're going to use this thing. And I don't want you ever using a digger because you don't know how to use one properly. So just use your fingertips because they're very sensitive and you're not going to do anything aggressive. You know, your fingers are not stronger than the pottery. But if I give you a knife, the knife is stronger than the pottery and you could hurt the pottery. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to slowly, calmly pull out every little piece. Be very careful. Here's a little sifter box for you. Put all the pottery pieces that you find. We're going to go down 6 inches over the next 2 weeks. If you get there earlier, there's no penalty, but just be careful. Then we're going to take a break from the dig, cover it all back up again, go off to this facility, and this pottery thing that you dug out, we're going to show you how to clean them off safely, all the little pieces and parts, and then I want you to try to assemble them into something that is logical. We need you to find all the edges. And then another group will come in and truly, truly deep clean them and put them all together and glue them together because you're not qualified to do that part yet. You could execute those little things. That's like finding truth, isn't it? You're not an expert, but it's pretty damn logical. They told you your whole life that A connects to B and that B connects to A. And then when you finally start doing your research, you're like, I don't think so. I don't think my government really gives a shit whether I'm healthy or not. Never in world history has any government truly ever cared about its people unless the people were a commodity that they were the equity to achieving some other bigger goal of the country. Then they protect the people so they can fight their wars. As soon as the war's over, you come back without a leg and an eyeball and half your face is blown off. Well, you got to get your own health care. Screw you, right? But this also festered in me because of the Pyramid Code special that the BBC did, aired it, then they yanked it, then it got broadcast on YouTube. The whole thing was uploaded kind of low res. Then it got popular enough and Netflix got desperate enough, they re-aired it in high quality with some licensing deal. Too bad you can't see the Great Global Warming Swindle on Netflix. Another one of those BBC shows that was created, they watched and said, who made this? This is going to undo everything. But anyway, back to the Pyramid Code. The Pyramid Code was a multi-series special on reinterpreting Egypt. And in terms of probably the Egyptian historians, it is most likely the biggest group of blasphemy out there because they started putting things together. Although they did miss the fact that the pyramids aren't in the hieroglyphs, but we'll just overlook that for now. So they had an electrical engineer go look at the pyramids. They had a guy who was an erosion expert look at the soil around the Sphinx. They had another guy whose background was Egyptology, but he was, you know, I don't know if he has a degree in it or not, but the dude is brilliant. And he went off and looked at the temples. But he also ended up coming back with one of the most profound epiphanies, of which I talk about on this show from time to time as I touch the Egyptology subject matter. But this shows you how old this theory could be, if this gentleman's correct. And again, you know, one of the things is that the way the show's put together, one of the people could be correct, another one could be wrong. It doesn't mean that the other one's incorrect, just to kind of cover that before you see it, if you haven't seen it. I think the observations were pretty conclusive, pretty brilliant, including finding the, just as a side note, they found this colony of people like 1,500 to 3,000 miles away or something that was still using hieroglyphs today as their script between each other, and they were able to further translate hieroglyphs in the 21st century. Okay, I think it's about 2013 when this was put together. They were able to find out that acronyms are a part of hieroglyphs, and that was singeing up a bunch of the groupings of letters that we weren't quite sure what exactly they meant. We knew through inference by reading the rest around it kind of what it probably meant, but this explained what we were looking at. But anyway, back to our subject. This gentleman, I apologize for not having his name on the top of my tongue. I don't think I've ever known his name. He pointed out a few things that were just amazing. I'd say several things that were amazing, but unrelated to what we're talking about, he flew drones over temples and proved that they're actually people walking. Like the top-down floor plan of the temple is a pharaoh taking a step with one of those skirts. And he takes you inside. He goes, you see how this entryway is a little bit off from this entryway? He goes, that's because that's a bent leg coming out of the center of the pelvis. And he goes into the temple. He goes all the way into like what would be the rib cage section. And there's a pillar for every rib in the ribcage of a human. Not one more, not one less. He gets into the chamber that would be the mind and the brain, which they had divided up like the scarab beetle, because the back of a scarab beetle looks like the top of a human skull. And he said, look, all the chambers that they believe that the mind had are in this room. And he used that as a segue to get to his other theory, which is that the crowns that the pharaohs wear that you see and all the hieroglyphs, one of them's really sharp. It comes up, it goes back, and goes back up. Another one's very round, okay? What traditional Egyptology says, which means you can probably throw it out the window, was that one of the crowns was North Egypt, and one of the crowns was South Egypt. And as this fabled character Menes unites North and South Egypt, that you ended up wearing the crown inside, the smooth crown, inside the sharp crown. What he said made this new guy made a hell of a lot more sense, okay? I mean, it's so unbelievably metaphorically almost on point. The round crown, he said, was the right brain and usually reserved for the females initially, and that the sharp crown was a left brain signification of a male brain. How do you divide that up? Well, if you think about a man that goes out and hunts every morning for food, it's a very left brain activity. You cannot be interpreting man like, is that like, you know, a water buffalo coming at me? No, you got to say, that's what we eat. We need meat. We fire arrow. We chase it. We're very logical. And we're trying to keep from getting killed by the animals and we're stalking them. So it's an extremely meticulous, logical thing to do. While the women are protected by the men to raise the babies. Well, babies are the most abstract things on planet Earth, aren't they? They have all different personalities, different needs, and it is the empathetic connection between a mother and the child that makes this process possible. Men can do it too if they get the opportunity. Again, it's just growing which part of the brain first. I used to think too that, you know, as I started looking at rock stars, which in America, it's just what you worship when you're a little kid. I think the fascinating thing about a male that writes music and sings is that you've got a male with a fully developed right brain who, on the other side, can't manage his finances and ends up broke after the 10 years of fame. You know, it's like, it's just, it's so in front of your face, in my opinion. But this gentleman said, look, and he explains how he got this theory. He explains the step-by-step process that he used to get to this opinion. He didn't just make it up out of thin air and go, hey, I'm going to impose this on everything that I've seen. But I've mentioned this several times again in my Egyptology episodes, but the statues of King Tut and his wife sitting together routinely have the wife with her arm around his waist, which is a caregiving statement and design. If you were to ask any traditional, say, nuclear family for probably the past 1,000 to 2,000 years, the male has always been traditionally the one to protect the woman, but this arm around his back sort of breaks that mold. And so his interpretation of that is that she is nurturing him into the right brain. And it is assumed that he will nurture her into the left brain, and therefore both of them will ascend together as a part of their journey here on Earth. You know, there's a traditional statement about geniuses in life, all kinds of the Greek theologians and many, many people have said, you know, when I went to university, when I learned a bunch of information that I've always wanted to learn, or I got through school, whatever, it's usually someone a little bit older, they'll say, what I learned the most is what I didn't know, or that I don't know anything. I'm butchering that, but you know what I mean. They get to this heightened state of awareness, and suddenly they feel like they're empty. In my opinion, what they have done is they've rounded off their brain, and the center portal has opened up. And just like my game analogy, there's an emptiness of our personal stored knowledge about what's on the other side of that chamber. But what I'm going to tell you is that that chamber is your science lab. It's your history lab. It is your personal laboratory to go in there and become something different. Something truly enlightened, to see more. And again, the first stage of enlightenment of the absolute mind is this shocking void that never before have you ever had an absolute mind thought until you have one. And the first epiphany is the total perspective vortex that you're like, oh my God, I am but a wee baby in this life. And you could be 60 years old and get your absolute mind worked out and you will feel perhaps even erroneously inadequate. It's not the truth, but because you're being real with yourself, because you have achieved this level of self-awareness to even know that the door opened, that you're not going to boast that you see more than you see. It's almost so crushing to the soul, and I think a really good way, once you frame it correctly, that you're being honest with yourself for the very first time. Because as you were digging around on the left, you're survival, survival, survival. Digging around on the right, you're trying to achieve something you never achieved in a creative realm. And you have to bullshit yourself, you know, if you're getting into a gigantic project. Sure, I can finish this project. I've never done anything like this in my entire life. But yeah, of course, that's the next thing I'm going to do. Logic can do the same thing. What's interesting about the absolute mind, because you're probably wondering, okay, dude, we get you. Give us some examples. First beautiful thing about being in the absolute mind is the following. And again, there's a bunch of you that have already gotten through this portal. You've already had that feeling that you didn't know anything. Let me ask you this. This is a test to see if you've got yourself inside that chamber. First, you have to have that experience. You realize you don't know anything. And it's not that you don't really know everything, know anything at all. It's just that the new species of information that you're getting is so beautiful and so complete. It looks like nothing you've ever seen before. So it's humbling. The next phase, in my opinion, is that now, you aren't a child when you have this epiphany. So you're surrounded by all your stuff. You're surrounded by your previous education. You still have all the trade skills in your brain that you use to make a living. You have all the interactions with human beings that you've been using to survive. You have your own thoughts, which allows you to exist in your own body without going crazy. The absolute mind lets you reassess everything you've ever done. And it'll be like you'll walk out your backyard and look at a flower and go, oh my God, they always said stop and smell the flowers. And I never got it. I thought it was a fruity hippie thing because I'm a left brainer. And oh my God, that thing is beautiful. You know, it's like you'll start seeing things like you've never seen them before. I think, I'm just speculating here. So I mentioned this, like, I don't mean to be dropping pro-drug comments in here, but before I took my first trip on acid, I was asking some of my big Hollywood buddies, and I don't mean to drop that. I'm just saying that they've done a lot of this stuff. And so I was like, I need some people I trust to tell me what this is going to be like, because it's a little freaky. They tell you about bad experiences, which I never have. But my writing mentor told me the best thing. I said, you know, how would you describe the experience? And it'd been years since he'd ever done it. He says, well, the best thing I can tell you is you're going to start connecting things that you never connected before. And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, you're just going to look at something and you're going to look at a chair and you're going to see it as a functional thing. Then you're going to think about the guy or girl who designed it. Then you're going to think about the manufacturer. Then you're going to look at this other thing and there's a connection between some aspect of the chair and the table. And then you look at Mother Nature. That's made of wood. And you're just going to have these. And it's so fluent and so fast. It's an incredible experience. Well, I think that's what the absolute mind does. Perhaps that drug helps one achieve a more absolute mind. Not sure. It's kind of weird. Most of my acid buddies are all very liberal old men at this point in their life. I'm not sure what that's all about. But it's like that when you start thinking clearly. It might be attributable to the thing we talked about on the show several times, which is when you're young, you're very impressionable. So a society tells you to hoard things, accumulate things, because that's going to define you. You know, you have a fancy car, you have a big TV, whatever the hell it is. You wear $10,000 worth of crap on a daily basis. I used to be stuck in that one. It wasn't $10,000, but I remember just at some point in my 20s going, wow, you know, I'm from this little hometown where if I wanted any nice clothing, I had to go earn my own money and buy my own stuff because my father was like bringing me home with no joke, man, like 6 pair of jeans and a 6-pack container. You know, it's just like, really? So yeah, there was no limit to the hazing I got as a kid, putting some of that crap on and going outside. But when you get older, you start to simplify and it starts to feel good. You start to stop, again, like I said just recently, you stop worrying about what other people think about you. Because the priority switch goes from these meticulous, sort of hyper-focused objectives that you were taught, either by family members, which is probably the least influential group, but by commercials, television, society, you know, just how to get a girl, how to get a guy, you know. There's these things that you do. You're supposed to walk in a room a baller, you know, in some parts of the world. And other times you're supposed to come in very humble, wearing cowboy boots and a giant belt buckle. I think I can almost say categorically, the people that I've known that have been able to express their joy of simplification, the sort of gestalt of what they're saying is all about kind of having an epiphany and waking up, going, I just looked at the world a different way when I woke up this morning. And all that shit I thought mattered doesn't matter anymore. I mean, you know, it's not like it's completely insignificant, but I can pick and choose now. Where before I had a chemical trigger to go get that stuff because I was so weaned onto these weird priorities. Here's another area of, I think, just wonderful epiphanies that can occur to you. When I started through Eric Dollard, as I keep saying over and over again, going into sort of ethereal sciences, it's an extremely left brain concept with a right brain fluid dynamics behavior. Then you have to reconcile this new sort of unified theory of all things down to every tangible object that you can discern from this microphone, this camera, this computer, this backyard, and to me, this organic being that is playing host to a soul. That's a lot of thinking, and that's a bunch of right brain abstract thought process that actually constitutes real mass and energy that is discernible for us to have interactions with. But it's all the logic and the math that actually makes it perform. You know, if I show you some pretty elaborate mathematics, starting from 1 plus 1 equals 2, all the way up to sort of basic geometry or I'd say, well, geometry is pretty right brain, but algebra, let's just say. Even though you're looking at the numbers and you're like, okay, yeah, I saw what you said. It's definitely not the way I think. And by the way, I don't use this anywhere in my entire life. You'd probably be right, okay? But when I show you a fractal pattern, those infinite fractals that keep just zooming down and zooming up, they get infinitely big, infinitely small, those Fibonacci patterns that are going in on themselves, suddenly your mind starts popping if you're trying to translate that into an algorithm. And the weird thing is, isn't it interesting once an algorithm starts to look organic? Wow, that's a merge of the two ideas. And do you have the mind to start thinking about this combined science between the left and right brain right in front of your face as a construct that actually creates plants, the succulent cactus that just exude the golden mean? If you want to research that, if you want to think about that in some homogeneous, holistic way, you're going to have that central brain opened up, and you're going to have to be able to take what you see from observable reality, plus your theoretical thoughts of how this could occur, into that room, because in that room is all the equipment you need. And the analogy that I'm forgetting to drive home is just like being John Malkovich, where he had a bunch of people in his brain telling him what to do. That room is actually inside you. If you want to contemplate the afterlife, boy, if I said to you right now, well, let's think about this. Okay, so you have a soul. For those of us who believe in that thing, it's not just because, it's because you've seen things and you felt things, and the more you use your brain in that centralized manner, it becomes pretty evident the symbiotic relationship we have with it. But if I said to you, how is heaven more left brain or is heaven more right brain? I mean, you're thinking about heaven, you're thinking, man, if there is a heaven, I don't have to do any more math, right? And so it automatically just floods the pedal over to the right side. It's abstract. It's cake and cookies and love and music. And you may not be wrong. I'm not saying I have a definition. I'm just using this as an analogy. But let's say you spend a few years there in heaven and you get through all of your addictions that you've always wanted to abuse, but you're okay. And then you're just sitting around, you're thinking about things, you're looking at heaven, you're looking at this place, whatever it is, right? You're thinking, well, there's still mathematics holding this place together. I mean, God is a math machine, if nothing else. And so you sit there until your absolute mind lets you, which may be what you attain the second you pass away, for you don't have any more biology limiting you. You don't have any more constraints of your brain / your sort of storage, long-term storage, and your short-term memory to hinder you like a filter. you can see it all. If you saw it all, if you saw all knowledge, even though you're not trying to know everything like God, you're not trying to memorize everything that's ever happened, that's unimportant to you. But there definitely are areas of interest. You might want to go back and say, okay, how did the earth form? What the fuck is the moon? You know, why is it the same size as the sun? It looks like a burned out sun. Were there UFOs? I mean, you know, specific things that you might be interested in. Let me ask you this. How many of you have ever been forced to watch a video in school, or you saw some special on the YouTubes or some History Channel, Discovery Channel, where you see rats at a maze? Or just studies of animals in general. Wildlife show. And you see the utter logical circuitry of a fox that's scared of you. You got whatever the fox eats. You just want to be close to a fox because they're kind of cool until you hear them make that weird noise. Yeah, but they're scared of you. You want to feed a bird, but the bird's terrified of you because they're living in a pure mechanical existence. It's not that they don't have love. You've seen two little parrots get together and kiss each other, right? You've seen dogs absolutely love each other as well as human beings, right? They're little love machines, right? But you have to wait for the context of those moments to occur, because in the wild, undomesticated, most animals go back to a feral state of logic. When you're viewing these creatures, and we don't ever say it out loud, we could be watching this, you know, this Omaha, I forgot that old show on TV in the 70s. Mutual of Omaha used to sponsor this thing, right? Anyway, you would see animals and you're thinking in the back of your head, well, look how mechanical they are. Do ants really exude anything like a party? No, man, they're just trooping along, man. Oh, it rained in the rainforest. Now they're going to all get together and create this weird little bridge where the little guys underneath the bridge are got a pocket of oxygen they're using to breathe, and everyone walks over there. I mean, it's like nuts, right? It's so left. So when we think about us as human beings, we've got the blessing of the access to a pure creative side. Think about a rich kid. A rich kid that doesn't have to work to make money and is actually self-motivated enough to create something with that spare time, to endorse the blessing of wealth, to create something wonderful on a daily basis, something the world could share or something the world could be entertained by. That's the ultimate state of the gifts of what this form of humanity, of being a Homo sapiens sapien, could achieve, is that freedom to be completely free. So we're going to get back to other examples, but let's talk about if this is something that interests you and you're like, man, I don't think I've got it, but I would love to have it. There are weird catchphrases I hear people say that are sort of the kiss of death for some of this stuff. And I'm completely built the opposite. You know, whatever is impossible, I'm like, let's do it. You know, so when I hear people say two things. And it's a way of perhaps moving forward in a more productive manner. I don't want to say it's not it's not completely unfounded to say these things. But I'll hear people say, oh, I'm just so not creative. I'm so not creative, you know. Or I'm horrible at math. Oh, God, I hate math. I'm just, you know, don't ask for me what 1 + 1 is. I won't know, you know. And they've kind of jokified this endorsement of a single dimension of thinking. Now, again, there's no crime to be happy with yourself and go ahead in one of those realms. And I don't mean to make anyone feel guilty if that's just your focus. This is just door number 3 when the price is right, okay? So you probably guessed it before I say anything. You have to give yourself your own report card, to be honest. Are you more left or are you more right? Now, there's 2 ways to do this. One may be less accurate, but it might seem like it's more accurate. And the other one might be right on point, but a little bit cloudier to discern. You might look at your day-to-day chores, your type of job that you might have. This is the more, of course, this will be a black and white report card of what I am as a human being. For instance, the people who tell me that they are not creative, they can't watch scary movies sometimes. And you go, why can't you watch scary movies? And they say, because I think about it as I walk around my house, the zombies coming at me and stuff. Well, haha. The thing is they've bought this stupid catchphrase about themselves not being creative. But the reason why they can't watch scary movies is because they're ridiculously creative. And it's this recessed energy to be creative that only comes out when fear is involved. Okay. Time to harness that for a different reason, right? People who say they're bad at math will be incredible logistical people. I know a mother of two kids. She'll probably say she's bad at math. But she has said that to me. And I guarantee you the math that she does on a daily basis to calculate when to get the kids up, to get them to school, to get to work, and all this other stuff, it's all mathematical. And it's so solved so immediately that she's actually like a little calculator. So if you're trying to give yourself a report card merely by looking at what you do on a particular day, make sure you go to that level. You could be like this brainiac accountant or tax person or some other type of engineer. Maybe you're a mathematician somewhere. And you're going to say, well, I know for a fact that my left brain's off the hook. I get paid lots of money to do this. Or regardless if you get paid money, you just know you're really, really good at that kind of stuff. Another person might be some crazy musician, just amazing creative person, and they're just constantly cranking it out, but not realizing that music is a mathematical equation. And they understand it like crazy. They know how to put together the bars and beats for a rock song or country song, for a rap verse structure. They know how to play the drums, which is totally mathematical, right? Doesn't matter what instrument you play. The reason why Bach stuff is so different and yet so thorough. That guy, if you look at how many of the keys that he wrote songs to play, he was teaching his children how to play the piano, is how he wrote about it in his later years. The guy had 20 kids, man. Three of them became master musicians, like C.P.E. Bach, okay? But you get up to Mozart, 100 years later, I don't know if it had anything to do with the environment or the culture maturing and getting out of more sort of functional operations of society. You know, again, once society builds more luxuries, the right brain can become part of the game. Every time you've ever seen cave drawings or those Peruvian illustrations in the desert, without saying it while you're watching the documentary, what you're thinking is, society must have gotten to a good state such that people could spend time putting rocks out in the desert to draw gigantic pictures of bugs and humans and alien-looking people and stuff, to even just carve something on the side of a rock or paint something in some ancient French cave. Well, obviously, their bellies were full. The society that they lived in was fine with them doing this. Plus, the thing is you don't just draw perfect the first day, right? And how many times have we seen cave drawings and cave paintings that have any inkling of the evolving artist within a particular generation of a single artist, right? Like, let's just say you had a big cave in Missouri or something like this, which Missouri has tons of caves, and you start seeing scribbles that don't look like anything, and you keep falling the cave deeper and deeper, and all of a sudden it gets really good, you know, because the person was crawling chronologically deeper into the cave, but getting better and better at their art. I personally don't know of any art that isn't amazing for the time that it was said to have been created. Now, some of that stuff could be fake, I don't know. Look at the Mayan stuff. Oh my God, it's just the writing. The alphabet is the most complex but also decorative alphabet to exist. Tremendous. We look at hieroglyphs. You have artistic symbols that were translated into phonetic sounds such that instead of having an icon for a dog, it was D-O-G. I mean, they figured out a way to sound it out, to create a finite amount of symbols, to create an infinite amount of language. That's left and right brain pushing together. So whoever created the linear phonetic languages was an absolute mind person. The logic of creating symbols, the right brain of creating expression, to understand the need. We're running out of these symbols. How do we teach everybody in the village all these symbols? I mean, China had to get out of that game because there was no way to make a keyboard on a computer with 40,000 symbols, right? and they figured it out. Japan had the same thing. They carried the ancient Chinese scripture up, writing styles, made their own, and then they found out, oh gosh, we want to be technical, so they created a phonetic version of their language. I know for a fact, as you are judging your own mind to figure out which one you need to lean on, because it's also important to know what you're already good at, because you can leap off, you can use the side that you're good at to get the other side. We'll get into that in just a second. Virtually everything that you've done in life came with either a challenge that was completely a mystery or a challenge that you'd never seen before, but because of previous challenges, you were like, oh, well, that just seems logical. Or, you know, it's like you have a drippy faucet in your bathroom. You need to get it fixed, but you got to go to sleep. And you don't want to listen to that doink, doink, doink. And so you're sitting there going, I need to stop that sound. And I can't just plug it up. It's not easy to plug a drain. Plus, you don't want to create any permanent solution that you have to undo every time you have to wash your face. So you just put a dish towel in the bottom of the sink, maybe at an angle, so that it doesn't just hit a perpendicular surface and splash. It leaks down a piece of cloth. Okay, well, that's both a creative thought and a logistical thought all at the same time. I think a cloth is a very abstract solution. The logistical part of it is I gotta go to sleep, and this is gonna bother me. But the other one is the more you've solved problems like this in the past, you know very well, you start developing this confidence and this faith that you have the capability of solving problems, which is the key to keeping your mind young. And it's not, again, memorizing and repeating stuff. Memorizing things is good for your table of lookups when you're being actually intelligent and trying to connect things together. But it is not important to just merely be a Jeopardy contestant and be the number one in the whole world that's ever been on the show. You haven't proven you can pass even the most basic entry-level Mensa test. I've told you guys several times about the story where I'm playing the piano at my friend's house. I was about 19 years old, and I'm just playing something I wrote. And it's just going, I just know the keys. I know where I can push it. I can minor key it, major key it, and I can just give you an emotion you're looking for at the moment. And this woman stood behind me I'd never met before, and she, all I hear from her for the very first moment is, gosh, I wish I could do that. I was like, ooh. And this was a woman visiting who played for the LA Philharmonic. And I'm like, but aren't you that woman that plays, you know? And she's like, yeah, yeah. And I said, well, what is it that you can't do? And she goes, I can't write my own music. I said, well, how many pieces do you think you know? And she says, oh, hundreds and hundreds of pieces. And I'm like, can't you just cut everything up into little pieces in your brain and stitch it together and make your own stuff? No, can't do it. Now, obviously, her telling herself she can't is her catchphrase that will keep her from ever doing it. But she had been so left brain recital playing her whole life. Here's sheet music, here's sheet music, here's sheet music. I'm telling you what to think, I'm telling you what to think, right? She wasn't able to be creative on her own. There's a little trick about singing a tune I've shared maybe once. And it is the difference between having an absolute mind about a song and having a left or right brain version of the song. A right brain person singing a song wants to look good on stage more than anything in the whole world. The left brain person is trying to get all the words right and maybe mechanically look like somebody on stage. But the absolute mind is going, who wrote this song? Who wrote it? When did they write it? What are these lyrics about? And this is where you stop singing goofy bullshit and you get into songs that actually touch your heart. And when you sing, you are reliving empathetically this experience that whoever wrote it, and you might know who wrote it, you know, it could be Robert Plant or something. Like I sing Heartbreaker. And even Whole Lot of Love or something like that. I mean, there is a story in there. And getting into it and understanding it is what the absolute mind provides for you. It's a full three-dimensional understanding of your existence. And it's a lot of fun. Because again, the game reset. But you reset with your tools, with your mental tools, all sharpened, all ready to rock and roll. If you've ever dreamed of like going back in time and becoming yourself with all the knowledge that you have today and going back into reality. And maybe you don't know that negative events are going to occur. You don't have that. You don't know exactly what stocks are going to go up. You just want to do it all again and do it better. Go back to school and get all its straight A's because you understand. But you can also goof off on the side because you already know a lot of those subjects. In terms of writing an essay, give me 15 minutes and a word processor, I'm done. That is a simulation, in my opinion, of an absolute mind approach to a previous experience. The good news is you can do it today with your life, and you can do it tomorrow or in the next second of your life. You will discover things about yourself you never saw before. And I will warn you, sometimes you can find some flaws in yourself. Don't be discouraged. Be happy. There's an interesting thing with software developers finding a flaw in themselves and a normal person finding a flaw in themselves. And I will say this. We're always taught that when you find a bug in software, it's a victorious thing. Why? Because the software gets fixed. And before the internet was out to patch all your problems, when we pressed the game on a CD and shipped it to, 10 million homes, it could not have a crash bug. It could not have anything that was fatal to the gameplay. And I mean meticulously nothing, right? So we learned that finding bad things, it was good. And so when you find a bad thing in yourself and your software developer, you got to take that Q&A sort of approach to a quality assurance thing. Or I should say QA, not Q&A. So use that little trick if you can. The one thing that will also dawn on you huge when you start getting this feeling, and these, I'm telling you these little examples so that you can understand the indicators that you are either already there or you're about to be there. And one of them is understanding the value of your time. It's huge. It's huge. I'm starting to, you know, I ebb and flow with the policing of my time, but anyone's wasting my time, I'm done. I'm done. I can't get into it. And it's just that the value of a second starts to have $1 billion attached to it. You know, that infinite amount of money that you'll never have access to. Well, a second of your time is pretty much that valuable. Now, of course, your body ebbs and flows with energy. So you have to sort of create a marathon symphony dance with yourself to say, okay, if I eat a bunch of sugar, I crash. If I drink a bunch of beer or liquor, I crash. So guess what? Fucking poof. Unless I am at that 4th of July party or whatever big party you have in your country, your family reunion, whatever, your birthday, and you're like, okay, today I'm going to allow myself not to do anything massively creative, even though in the back of your brain you're like, this is all I'd want to do is go home and work on my thing. I've worked with a number of professionals, obviously both personal and professional, and there's an interesting thing that starts to happen when you create your own business. When you create your own business and you are literally taking care of the money and the job and the solicitation of the work, and it's just a one-man show for a little while, meaning both men and women, of course, you start to be forced into this harmonic that will potentially open the door. And again, if you don't know it's opening, you may not be able to take advantage of it, even though you're suffering the beauty of it, to mix metaphors, okay? But I remember a girlfriend of mine, she started a business and it was really, really tough. And for a while there, it was sort of when we hung out at Disneyland or something, it was all about the escape. We're in Disneyland, we're thinking about Disneyland because, you know, it's rough when we get home. As the business started to succeed, I look over at her and while we're standing in line and I just see her staring like 60,000 feet, man. And I've been there, so I knew what she was doing. And I said, what you thinking about? And she's just like, I said, you're thinking about some part of your client's job, right? She's like, yeah, totally. I'm thinking about whether I want, you know, this fabric or that fabric or whatever, you know. And I said, that's what happens when you start your own business. You just start to live it. Because typically you don't start your own business. It's something you'd never want to do. So you're starting it in some capacity that you're in love with. The other thing too is this. Let's say your life is, it's okay. But it's starting to kind of approach that level of mundane. Maybe you're already in that mundane loop. You're like, I don't hate my life or anything. I like it, you know, got my little loops, my shows I watch, whatever it is. But you're like, man, I need some spice, man. I'm not too old yet, right? No matter how old you are, you're like, man, I still feel good. I got a lot of energy. If you pursue the absolute mind intentionally by bathing yourself in what it is that you think that you need to start that up, and you might need to push yourself on the left and go, okay, this is way too easy. So I'm part of your lefty already. And then you push yourself on the right. Oh, this is a little more difficult, but it's a lot of fun. And you push, push, push until you get both these hemispheres to start working together. What'll happen during that void? Well, I should say, as a result of the void experience of going, whoa, I don't know if I know anything, is that new things you never thought of in your life, not that you necessarily thought they were impossible, but there could be some of those as well. Previously, you thought, man, there's no association between these two things. And all of a sudden you're like, chocolate and peanut butter and chocolate, Finkel and Einhorn, you know, whatever. It starts to create new things that you can do that you never thought you would be interested in. It's not even a difficulty concern at all. It's just, I didn't think I'd ever be doing this. Again, this is going to be an analogy to sort of what I'm talking about. It's going to sound completely unrelated, but I assure you it is. As sort of forces in our planet try to get us to do things we don't want to do, and they're trying to control us more and more, there's a group that's older, I would say predominantly the baby boomer generation, predominantly, of course there's people awake in all realms of ages, they were ready to lay down. They really were, because the government was mostly honest with them in their perception. And so, yeah, why don't we just do what everybody says, you know? The next generation down was the first totally abused generation, with divorced parents being 95% of, you know, every single country, and just you're getting beaten around. We're living in the boom and bust cycles of everything. And because we had to be dynamic to continue to exist in this abused realm, we started building up both sides of our brain because it was necessary to do that. Now, when you tell us a lie, we can see it just blatantly. We know you're a liar just by your body language, your sort of sketchy past. We listen to what you say and then we check it, as opposed to the previous generation, which said, oh yeah, Biden's had 50,000 jobs, you know, okay, you know. So we are more discerning with our circuitry. Now, there's other elements that they figured out on how to completely pulverize the younger generations and indoctrinate them from the very beginning to make them focus on false crises that don't exist. So they've got them preoccupied with, why do humans like to drink tea, you know? For me, this has become huge, and I'm just a little baby inside this door, in my opinion. I've told you guys about this Infinity Project, in which the Infinity Blind Spot episode goes into more detail about that. But you imagine a bunch of mathematics that run the world, but we also have a spiritual reality to our existence, plus we have sort of our abstract right brain side of things. And if we were to try and acknowledge both, you know, say God came down here and said, I exist, motherfuckers, and you all have a soul, and there are some rules to this place. That's all I'm going to say. I've already taught you everything you need to know. I sent down a guy who wants to tell you how it works later. All of a sudden, an undeniable imperative to figure out how this all works together is dropped on man, but the solution's not there. And that's sort of a false pretense of why my Infinity Project is what it is. It is to figure out a way to deal with the fact that we live in an infinite realm and all metrics of existence, but we also have this very tangible identity that is our soul, and then our sort of instance of infinity, which is our body. You only borrow time. You only borrow your body. You only borrow the earth for any one length of time, and then you're released back into the wild of infinity. And if we are to ever develop any advanced theories about how we think about how this all comes together, someone has got to create a left brain mathematical model on how to grasp infinity, but also bring together a spiritual architecture for how we see the world to exist, and then blend them together, right? It's like oil and water. How do you blend an algorithm with the soul? And that's what I've been trying to parse. this absolute mind state is giving me progress where that was sort of this inconceivable concept, say 15 years ago. I give you that example so you can see the utter power of this absolute mind and what it can bring to you. And the one thing too that I'll give a Stan Myers example. I think a lot of you know who Stan Myers was, but it was a guy that created this beautiful perforating piston. And it's not a piston that goes up and down. It's just shaped like one. And it oscillated tap water and pulverized hydrogen out of it infinitely. You know, whatever tap water you put in there, dirty tap water, it pulverized hydrogen out of it. And then he built a system that you could retrofit your car with. Well, this guy was a farmer by nature. But then he's out there working, and you know he was thinking. He was just thinking about the problem. And his spirituality, which I think in the end got him killed, was that he trusted that he had guardian angels that would always protect him against people that wanted to hurt him, and he got poisoned to death at a dinner with two investors from Europe. And they think they were Turkish, but no one really knows. And how the fuck they got away, I do not know. But he was given some cranberry juice, and someone slipped some stuff in it, and he ran outside and died, right? So, in my opinion, what happened to him was that the imperative was coming from the right brain, which is to save humanity from all of these energy companies that are basically controlling the entire planet, controlling the value of your money, controlling everything. They have so much money that they have infinite power, because man will take money as a primitive mind state. Greed is the only algorithm you need to breed in a man to turn him into a killing machine, period. Whether it be a mind-killing machine or a physical-killing machine, they'll become the sociopath for greed. He didn't have the greed, necessarily. He did want to get paid for what he was doing. But he went off and did a left brain thing as a result of his right brain imperative. He had a very godlike spiritual right brain and brought it all together and was able to do something that you can look up the schematics for and do it in your backyard. Just don't let him catch you, because he'll come after you. When I started thinking about the pyramid code analogy, what started to occur to me was that we don't talk about the absolute mind ever existing in any way, shape, or form. And if you know of another study or another philosopher that came up with a centralized term, please drop that on me. I'm sure they have. But when I was listening to this guy talk about the Egyptian husband and wife coming together, we don't have, at least in my whole history of my life and research, a word for it, and we don't have any educational expectations of what that would be like. So they're wearing both crowns, let's just say, and you subscribe to this theory. It's a great theory, regardless if it's true or not. And so the idea is, what is that mind like? What would that be like to be completely unified on both sides? And when do you, and the thing is, I don't think, unless you're God, you're fully accomplished in the absolute mind, which makes it a beautiful game that you can play for the rest of your life. I can only imagine that the women that have gone through the process of bearing children and raising them, I would say fairly successfully, because you can't control your kids, but you did what you needed to do, whether they turn into a good person or bad person or whatever, that's not your game, right? There's so much influence on them, you could teach them all the right things and they could still turn into a bad thing. So what I'm saying is, let's take a woman who raises some children and she has gone into deep right brain. Her kids always felt loved. She was always there for them. She was almost empathetically there for them before they even knew they needed it. Then she goes out, once they go into school, and she gets a job. And she becomes very successful. Perhaps she even starts her own business eventually. Imagine the amazing feeling. And I have friends that I should ask this, but there has to be this amazing feeling of having achieved both sides of the hemisphere. That they probably, while they were raising kids, doubted necessarily if they could succeed in the private sector, depending on their education, right? A lot of women go straight into raising kids. They don't get a formal education, then they have to get it after. Or they don't need it. They can learn whatever they need to learn to do whatever they love to do. I'm not sure men get that as easily, because there's no logical path for a man to get that unless, again, they are in a very creative sport, you know, something artistic, whether it be music or art or something, making movies or whatever. But they still have the logistical burden of taking care of demographics and that kind of stuff. It is a bummer, but when you do write a film, you have to know there's an audience out there for what you're writing. And the bigger the audiences get today because of the sheer distribution and exposure of whatever you make, you have to somehow be true to the story and not compromise the story, but have something for as many people as you possibly can. I don't find that terribly restricting. I find that a lot of fun. I find that when I collaborate with people and they go, well, you know, I think this scene's really about this, and I want, you know, there's nothing in here for women, you know, whatever. That's why I have females categorically review my scripts once they're done. That way, I don't worry. I'm a guy. I brought that to the game. I want the other side of the fence. Then I go to the dudes, right? Life is very, very interesting. And if you believe that there's any sort of creative force that dictates the design of life, okay, then you have to assume, I think, that this is sort of like an onion. And you can go through a fairly mundane life, although very happy and wonderful. There's nothing wrong with that. And you've only peeled maybe a layer off the onion, maybe two. But the more you experience life and the more that you are inquisitive about life and push yourself into all these esoteric subjects of thought and start to parse the very metrics of what it is to be alive. You know, just think about your five senses that you're told you have, even though you've got probably infinite additional senses. Those five, well, it's like playing five chess games at the same time, isn't it? You have all these different things going on at every split second of the day. I honestly think some senses are very left brain and other senses are very right brain. And then, of course, you have the intangibles like your emotions, your love, your hate, your desire, whatever. Talk about the, you know, the categorical summit of abstract, intangible experiences that you really have in this world. It's your emotions. And let's say you wanted to really dive into what that meant. This absolute mind will absolutely give you the tools to start putting words where you couldn't put words before, to tangibly feel the emotion with your hand, you know, on a level. You got master writers out there that will create these scripts that, my God, they've got you in their hand. They've got you exactly where they want you. Every step of the script, you know, like Avatar gets beat up a lot because it got super overhyped. And so I've almost never met anybody who loved the movie. But there's some brilliant stuff. I sat and watched that film, and yeah, I tried to see it twice and got turned away because the theaters were full. And then so I'm sitting in this theater going, okay, here comes this Avatar thing. So I had this sort of, you know, cynical view of it. How could it possibly live up to all the hype? Obviously, graphically, it blew us all the way to 2007. Don't forget that's when it was made. But there's the center part of the film, which if you haven't seen it by now, you know, spoiler alert. When the tree comes down in the center of the film. It's a very gut-wrenching situation. But in order for me, because I was in the pocket, man, I was feeling so verklempt, man. I was like, oh my God, this is horrible. In order for me to care about a CG tree in a movie, the scriptwriter had to perfectly set up the value of that structure to me. What it meant, its deep, deep meaning. And you might attribute that all to a right brain situation, but I don't think it is. I think that it's almost like an abstract tent that comes down to poles that go into the ground, right? So the poles are very right or very left brain that hang onto the soil to hold you down on this thought. I thought it was a masterful moment in the script. And then I saw Doctor Who's Kinda episode 1982, and I was like, oh, that's where that movie came from. I also found out Alien came from another Tom Baker episode. One of his first episodes he ever did. This alien had taken over a human body and laid eggs in it and changed it. And it was like, oh boy, no original thought in this world. Of course, it's all coming out of sci-fi novels I probably never read from the 40s, 50s, and 60s. But It's interesting how that stuff is all gets munched up and rebranded for us and done well, might I say. Now, looking back on this particular show on YouTube, I will say that if you're pretty addicted to this show, because I'm all over the place in all kinds of different forms of thinking, this is probably not a bad course to brute force the development of both sides of your brain, to be honest. I don't think it was an intent of mine to do that. I think it's just a byproduct of how I think. So, you know, it's a longer route maybe than you doing it by yourself, I would say. But if you don't have any logical trails to follow to stimulate yourself on both sides of the fence, I will definitely tell you getting to old episodes you haven't seen, continuing to watch, will most likely get you on that side. Even if you don't quite understand maybe some of the more esoteric crap I talk about, even sitting there listening to something that is being spoken to you, unless I start speaking gibberish, your mind is understanding what I'm saying on some level that you may not consciously understand. That's just the way we are when we communicate with people. Haven't you been in a situation where you sit down into a movie that's already in session just because your buddy started it, or you joined the cigar lounge while they're playing a movie and you're like, you know, you don't want to disturb them, what's this movie about? You know, you just sit and watch and then you start deducing, oh, okay, yeah, okay, that's brother and sister, or that must be the bad guy. Oh, no, that's the good guy, you know, and you start figuring it out. Very good experience for your brain. Funny story, people ask me, did you ever watch Game of Thrones? And my answer is, well, yeah, sort of. The dude who was showing it to us bought the box set, and he accidentally, I don't know how you accidentally do this, but the way the box was designed, and this is funny, I think it was like a fold-out box, right? So he had some, chronologically, Americans go to the left because we read right. He was Chinese, and so he grabbed something in the center, maybe the first disc he saw, popped it in, and we're watching, we don't realize we're watching season 4. And so we're like, what the hell's going on? Am I supposed to understand what's going on? Why are they talking about these past events, you know? So we missed the first 3 seasons. I've never seen the first 3 seasons. But the show was kind of, I don't know, it was pretty boring for most of us. It was just, everybody's a bad guy. So we're like, kill them all. Who cares, man? I don't care. But the other tool you might use is to think about your evolution, your maturation from childhood to pre-adolescent to a young adult to older adult. It doesn't matter if you're even just 20 years old listening to this, you will have probably a more photographic memory of what you did in your teens and your under 10 and under. And if you just watch how your brain developed, how you couldn't see things that other people could see. And the big analogy is your parents could see you were doing something dangerous. You didn't know it was dangerous. And either they let you have the experience and get burned, or they swatted your butt and told you what you're about to do is walk off a cliff. Don't do that, you know? Just on that note, I've got an experience I've said once before on the show. This is a crazy thing that happened to me my first day of school. Probably mentioned about 30 or 40 episodes ago. But it triggered my mind to think more completely. So I'm going to give you this little experience I had as a 5-year-old kid. I think I was 4, actually. I was 4. And you go find one in your mind that's like this. It was sort of a tragic situation that had a good ending. So know that this person's fine now. But it was my first day of school. And so we had the, you know, the weirdness of being dropped off from your mommy and you're like, eh. And then you go to a school, it's kindergarten, which for Americans back in 1974 was half a day. And you sit with the teacher, you know, you whatever, you drink your milk, you sleep on your mat, and then you got to leave. Well, we had done some artwork on the first day. So we walk outside, my buddy and I, and we're standing on the sidewalk waiting for our parents to pick us up. Well, just like a movie, this little fat kid comes up, and I don't know what grade he was in, probably 3rd grade or something. He just walks up and grabs my buddy's artwork out of his hand. We're just minding our own business, right? Straight up Hollywood. Like, I didn't think this kind of shit ever happened until I saw this happen. He takes the kid's art and throws it in the street, which is this brick street. And so he's, you know, we're all like, and like, who's this guy? And then the kid goes, you know, he's like, what are you doing? He goes out to grab his papers in the street. Well, I look to my left, and here comes a Jeep. It's 74, so just do your mouth on what the model was. And it's a blue Jeep, with no top on top, and these two women, a mother and her daughter, who must be in her 20s, and I see her looking over, just like a movie, man. Just, oh, the music would have been great. It's like two different scenes going, you know. It's like the minor key going for the kid and getting his stuff stolen, and the major key for the woman driving down the street. And all of a sudden, she must have slammed on her brakes, is the only thing I could think. But she hit his face with the right front panel in front of the tire. Thank God there was a panel there. And it, boom, hits him in the face and crushes a bunch of the bones in his face, you know. This is my first day at school, right? This woman jumps out of the Jeep. Of course, she's feeling absolutely destroyed. Picks the kid up. And I just remember, I can see it in my head. She's carrying him up the stairs into the school, just screaming, you know. And his face is just bleeding out of all the holes in his head, right? And I don't have any knowledge of death. I don't know injury causes death. I just have nothing. But I'm thinking, that's not good. Now, later on, miraculously, man, I went over within the year and to play with him, and he was indistinguishably perfect. Like, his face was perfectly fine. But he's telling me this story about, he says, yeah, they had to fix the bones in my face. And I don't know what he's really saying. I kind of know, but I kind of don't know. He's like, yeah, they fixed my face and stuff, and he's fine. No damage, didn't lose his teeth or anything that I know of. And then his brother came out with his poop from the bathroom. So that was a fabulous finale to the movie. But anyway, this experience threw like paint into my brain of like, people get hurt. People are bullies. People can recover, you know. And of course, it evolved over time because he was just totally injured. But I remember going home not terribly in shock about the moment because I couldn't perceive what had just happened to him entirely. I was 4, you know. So if you've had an experience, whether you be young or old, that just shocked you. I mean, you know, we've got tragedies in history going back 20 years. And if the first time you see it, it's mind-blowing. And then the next time you see it, you're like, let's follow the money, shall we? And you start to learn how to think. I know you guys get it. I'm just giving you as many examples as possible, just in case you're responding more to one example than the other. But let me know in the comments, like, if you had these sorts of experiences. Have you hit that rock bottom where you learned so much you realize you didn't know anything? Do you think you have an absolute mind? Have you known this? Use a different term for it. Maybe again, someone else has a term for it I've never discovered. And that was helpful for you. So any other ideas you have about exercises to discern whether or not this process has started, or to get it started, or to move your mind in one direction, or successes you've had in this. I'm willing to bet no one's had any failures. Honestly, you're good at what you do. You know, I always tell young art students, you know, kids especially, I'll say, hey, you know, the beautiful thing about learning how to draw is that you never get any worse. You always get better, no matter what. And then I teach them, can you draw the alphabet? And they say, oh, yeah. And I said, then you can draw every single shape of every single thing that you see with your eyes. And they're like, what? And I say, what's the shape of my eyeballs? Well, circles, you know. Yeah, great. You know what a football looks like, right? Well, that's the outside shape. But they just start to see what they couldn't see before. And that's fun to give to a child, you know. But you're never too old for these new tricks. I don't care what anyone says. No one's listening to me if they're into zero change in their life, I'll tell you that much. But anyway, if you haven't been to deepthoughtsradio.com, please go, bookmark it. We got to protect ourselves against the changes coming next year. Pretty sure we're all right, but you just never know. And the website has everything you need, the podcast, the video, lots of alternate social media you can get into. Some folks from our group are really into different ones. You know, and I think I've got listeners over there that don't come to any of the official stuff because they'll get videos on BitChute or Odyssey. So as soon as it goes on YouTube, it goes on Odyssey, and Odyssey's got a beautiful player. I have to manually update them for a BitChute, and BitChute's all 1080p, whereas YouTube's 4K and Odyssey's 4K. just in case you got a nice TV and you want to get your money's worth. But we have all the social media, all new remastered season one, a store. And for those of you who want to get the stuff ahead of time, head on over to Patreon. For those of you who go through PayPal, thank you so much. Just know that when I get emails through PayPal, I only say this every once in a while, I get your name, but I don't get your contact information, which is kind of cool, right? It's kind of an anonymous way. I know your name, but I don't know. And I put your thing in the credits when that happens. So you get in the credits full time, and then you you also get the episodes up at least a day early, sometimes 3 days early, and you get access to me if we hit a certain level of contribution. I have to say that because someone might come and try to put a buck in and get a time with me, and then they pull the buck out. So I didn't just wait till you accrue just a little bit. But everyone I've met's been amazing, like I say. So anyway, leave me your comments. Let me know what you're thinking. And until next time, take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.